You're listening to Builderpedia, your go-to podcast for everything you need to know about property. By covering the entire journey from buying your home through to design, building, selling, and everything in between, we'll help you fill in the blanks and bring your property vision to life.
Welcome to Builderpedia. Today's guest and friend of Builderpedia, Andrew Durbidge, whose name I got wrong before, I'm sorry.
Always a pleasure to be here. Good to see you again, Matt.
Welcome. And we were just talking before about how busy you are. Are you crazy busy yet or just busy?
Yeah, I think crazy is the right adjective. It's busy in my little corner of the construction playground at the moment, which is high-end housing. And I guess that's good. That means people are, at least in the high end of town, are still building, still engaging architects and still engaging good builders. So, yeah.
I had another friend of Builderpedia, Matt Hasten, last week, and he said, yeah, the A-grade properties are doing well, like the people who have money in the bank earning good interest are very happy at the moment. So yeah, it'd be great to see that sort of transfer over to the rest of the economy, I guess.
Absolutely, yeah. It is a food chain though, isn't it? You have people that enter town, you know, engage a good quality architect. They work on it for a bit. It gets to the stage where it's just out of DA. They then engage their consultants and then people like myself get pulled into the mix. And we do our design, and then a few months after that, it filters down to the likes of yourself and the good quality builders. So I'm always buoyant when I hear that architects are busy because you know the work's going to come our way 3 to 6 months after that, and then it falls your way 3 to 6 months after that with a bit of luck. So
yeah, absolutely. And it's funny, some architects are very, very quiet. Other architects have never been busier, so I don't know what's happening out there. It's really strange. I think since the last few years since COVID, nothing surprises me anymore. Like everything's strange.
You don't want to gaze too deeply into your crystal ball.
Yeah, for sure. So today I thought we'd have a talk about costs. And Andrew, you pushed back a little bit. You were like, what do we know about costs? Why are we talking about costs? But I think one of the problems is that costs are talked about by economists and other people higher up in terms of accreditation and qualification to talk about economics. And I think that if more people had a conversation about building cost and building efficiency and generally like if hands-on people were more involved in consulting to government agencies, that would be better. That's my gut feel.
Absolutely. And I was just wearing my structural engineer's hat and thinking, well, as a structural engineer, how much visibility do I have of overall costs in a construction project? And look, for the benefit of listeners, the hat I wear is a structural engineering hat. I'm a design and structural and site engineer for high-end homes, which is a euphemism for large houses for rich people.
Architectural homes, I guess.
Architectural homes. It's a better way to put it. Thank you. As opposed to the project homes put out by the volume builders. And as a structural engineer, inherently we know that you can come up with solutions that are more expensive than others. We understand the relativity of it. You know inherently that an off-formed concrete house is going to cost more than one that's timber stud frame. Where engineers traditionally don't have great visibility on the costs of a job will be things like a builder's holding costs. You know, the cost of having the scaffolding up for 3 months, 6 months, 12 months, the cost of labor, the cost of lead times. Engineers can sometimes have a bad habit of specifying a product because it's there in our product manual in the catalog on our desk, or we got an email from the sales guy and we thought, oh, this looks a good product. And we put it in our drawings and may not have an appreciation that the poor builder's got to wait 6 months for that to come in from Germany or something like that. Yeah, in the overall costs of a job for Mr. and Mrs. Smith who want to start a home renovation or do a knockdown rebuild, the costs obviously start from day one, even just, you know, engaging the very first consultant you talk to your application fees with council, to eventually signing up with a builder and then the cost of the build. And you've often spent an awful lot of money before your builder even gets to site and gets his shovel off the back of a truck. So there's a huge range of costs there. And obviously the structural engineer has some say and input, and we've had this conversation before, arguably a fair bit of influence as to where costs can be gained or lost. But the funny thing is I rarely actually ever get to see the bill of quantities. I rarely get to see how much does it cost to do a 270 cavity brick wall as opposed to a stud wall, as opposed to a concrete frame wall. I don't often get the visibility of that. The best I'll get is at the end of the job and I'll find out that it was a $3 million house or a $4 million house or something like that. So individual breakup is the bit that I have less visibility of. But by the same token, you're at the other end, and certainly the pointy end, where every single line that an engineer or an architect puts on their page has a dollar figure attached to it. And we all work hard to try and improve those dollars if and where we can.
One insight that I have is there's mad system in place where there's such a like separation between architects and engineers and builders in a typical architectural home. And I'm presuming in a large part of the industry, there's separate contracts to the client, right? And it's funny because I had this kind of funny moment with talking to an architect where they were just appalled by the fact that our company, Ballast Point, my company, takes on the engineering contract. Like, we hire the engineer on behalf of the client, and most architects are absolutely terrified of hiring an engineer. So they will make their client hire every consultant on a separate contract separately and the builder separately. So the typical client who engages an architect will engage an architect and a planner and an engineer and a hydraulic engineer and whatever else they need, and then the builder, and they're all on separate contracts. And they all come at different times as well. So I guess one of the things that we found great economy with is integrating all of those services. And if I had the ability, I would have an in-house engineer. If we were big enough and we had that sort of demand, we would have an engineer on our staff, because integration means that we can focus the whole team from the outset. For one, we can set the objective is cost reduction or economy. We can set the objective for the whole team and focus everyone on that. But secondly, the evidence is overwhelming that a diverse team creates a better outcome. So having that diverse team from the outset and integrating them, and for us, that's bringing in someone from the build team to advise on drawing reviews and early plan reviews, is hugely beneficial. We save more money than the value of our fee on some projects by integrating a builder. And sometimes that's myself, sometimes that's someone else in our business. But I think one of the key questions that save up to 50 grand off the bat is, why have we got four little roofs? What if that was one roof pitched one way with a gutter on the end of it, rather than four little rooflets joined and in weird? And sometimes there's a very good reason for that. But 9 times out of 10, just happened like that. It was a death by a thousand cuts, and we were looking at that and trying to create spaces internally and trying to create volumes that are visible from the outside or not visible from the street. We've arrived at something, and who will see those four roofs, and who will know? And it's the same with skylights, where glass roofs are a scourge of construction. They always fail. They're always expensive. They're always problematic. So again, it's like, well, what if we had a row of skylights? And I can guarantee you that I would walk 100 people through a building at random and ask them whether there was a glass roof or skylights above the stairwell, and no one will actually know, because the light is what the problem that's solved is light. Whereas a glass roof or skylights, it's really just a vanity piece sometimes. So
I think you made some really fascinating points there, particularly the whole point about architects are loathe or scared or run when you tell them about you catering on that contract. And I suppose there's a bit of history there. There's a bit of tradition. There's also probably some ugly commercial realities that play into that. And that's just simply risk and professional indemnity insurance. If you're a small architectural practice, you probably don't have the fees to take on that level of project management where you are engaging and overseeing the other consultants directly. You may not have the skill set. Certainly, engineers come out of uni knowing how materials go together, but project management and all the rest of it is left off our curriculum. And I suspect it's probably the same for architects, who obviously have to learn an awful lot amount of stuff, but running a business and engaging consultants and contractors and project management might be an elective, but I don't know how much it falls into their overall training. And so these are things that you tend to pick up depending on your employment and the company you work with. And you're coming from a position of having been on all sides of the fence, seeing the benefits, seeing an opportunity, and seeing where improvements are made. But that's the benefit of you having as many years in the industry as you have. But yeah, it's that classic thing about it's not the most efficient system when Mr. and Mrs. Smith have, as you say, four or five different contracts with all these consultants and someone stitches that together. And the person who stitches that together is ultimately the project manager. And certainly in a lot of the residential projects I'm involved with, there is not a project manager other than the architectural firm who probably aren't being paid the amount they should to undertake all that. And so we have what we have.
But it's a fundamental approach to risk where for the default for architects, and architects have this drilled into them at architecture school, your level of risk increases if you take on additional contractors. And I'm looking at it from a integrated service provider, the greater risk is that I don't have control over who I hire and who we work with. And for me, that's an unacceptable level of risk to not have Andrew Durbridge or another Durbridge. Sorry. God, it's because I had a contractor that was Debridge. It's stuck in my head.
There was a racehorse called Durbridge that did the rounds a few years ago and it won a few races and everyone thought it was part of, you know, my family owned it. And I had to say, no, we've only got one R in our name and we ain't into horse racing.
I think there should be a penalty for every time I get your name wrong. There should be like
a... Well, this is why most people just call me AD.
AD, all right.
I go by AD. Yeah.
Sorry. Anyway, off the rails.
That's right.
But if you don't have someone competent, if you don't have someone that you've got a working relationship and you can trust and you can work with, that is a huge risk to take on as a builder, architect, whoever you are. That's hugely risky. But I think for a customer... It's the reverse is true, where they unwittingly take on all the risk of having these separate contracts with people who have very little, well, no contractual relationship to each other. So I wonder, my curiosity is how much that impacts, because without being integrated, those people don't talk. They talk at different stages, but they kind of get, it's more like they get the plans passed along to them. They scribble on them, then pass them to the next person. Like there's not a discussion.
100%. And this is where the system does break down. And believe me, I mean no disrespect to any architects who might be listening, but I've been involved with more projects than I can count where the architect was supposed to be managing all the consultants and the coordination of details and didn't. And the classic one is the structural engineer and the hydraulic or stormwater engineer. Now, those are two consultants who need to be talking very early on in the piece. And the way most projects unfold is the structural engineer gets engaged first and goes away and works out all the steel beams and the depth of the joists and the concrete slabs and all the rest of it and hands it back to the architect. And then much later in the process, and I'm not quite sure why this is, but later on the hydraulic engineer gets involved and then they design their gutters and their downpipes and their penetrations and all the things. And no one coordinates that. And then poor builder starts on site 3-6 months later. And they've made a phone calls where only then do you find out that there's a penetration or a gutter or something that's cutting right through the most critical steel beam on the job that's doing all the work. And then the builder's got to try and has to stop work, solve the problem. There's a variation in one form or another, either for people's time or for solutions to get around it. And it costs money and it costs time and it's a headache for everyone. That could have been avoided if consultants were brought in and allowed to shake hands and talk to each other early on in the process. And that's where your model of having an integrated system with everyone, if not physically under the one roof, at least under the one conceptual roof, talking at the start of the job is the way to go. That's how you save time, save costs. But sadly, our industry is not great at working better to avoid those problems.
I mean, we don't use digital twin technology. We don't use ARCHICAD in our practice, but we don't integrate every last component. It's not that I'm skeptical of digital twins and BIM and all of those high-level things. I've always just thought that the benefit of them was overstated. And sometimes there's more work involved in putting them together than the value delivered by having everything virtually designed. But do you use BIM and are we just behind?
My experience, I think, has been similar to yours, where I've been involved in projects where there's been BIM to some level of detail, it's rarely proved to be beneficial. I was involved in a much, much larger job. It was an aged care facility where we were all told we had to use a particular bit of software, some Revit. It was all had to be done by BIM, and it caused more trouble than it solved. And my lasting memory is the project manager on that job lamenting to us about 6 months later. And she actually said out loud at a consultants meeting, it was a mistake for us to go down the BIM route on this
and
job.
And BIM, have you got a good explanation of BIM? Because I'm wary that someone listening doesn't know what we're talking about.
That's a very good question. Is it building information management? Have I got that wrong? No.
It's just BIM. We BIM.
Yeah, we're all referring to it.
I guess it's the concept of putting every bit of like creating a virtual building in 3D, right? And having every item that's structural, hydraulic, and electrical integrated in one conceptual model.
Yeah, sorry, building information modeling. And the classic one where it's rolled out a lot, and this is maybe where it does have its uses, is in large jobs where you might have large aircon ductwork and services that's got to sit underneath a slab. Like a hospital is a great example, or a commercial building. And you obviously need to make sure that the ducts don't clash with other services and pipes. And that's great in a large commercial or industrial or specialized building like a hospital or a high-rise office block in the city. But for domestic housing, no. All I've noticed is that if you go turn to the consultants and the drafts people who tend to use Revit as an example, my experience has been is that it adds to the costs and doesn't necessarily do anything that we couldn't have worked out with just regular 2D AutoCAD and sketches by hand. That's not to poo-poo it, because it certainly has its advantages and benefits, and there are people who champion it. I'm not here to disparage or disagree with that. I guess to answer your point, I've just not really seen a huge benefit of it in my little corner of the playground.
Yeah, and inverse to that, whenever someone talks about technology in construction or the next innovation, or if you do a cross-section of startups in construction-related industry or prop tech, or is BIM and its digital twin is all a rage. And I think, I mean, one of the things that makes it appealing is kind of like green rooms, where you can have nice images and you can show it in nice sort of 3D, and you can show drawings that are beautiful and technical and fully integrated, and you can show it off. But I think it's one of those things like green rooms, like prefab housing, that is a great concept, like the very fast train that. And it's a nice idea, but when we pay for it, will it create a return on investment, you know, and how much does it cost to get there? So it's one of those things. But I think I'm kind of thinking about, well, what are the simpler things? What are the simple ways that a builder, an architect, what are the simple things that reduce cost? One thing that I've stumbled upon is decreasing the quantity of different materials in a build. And we had, on a job that you and I were both involved together, I deliberately asked you to delete a beam, which for you was a way to simplify the job and lighten the slab. And for me, it was a way to make the job quite more complicated than it needed to be. So I think that was one area where I wanted to explore, where I'm going, well, engineers have this ambition to reduce thicknesses and reduce things, but not necessarily to simplify what happens on site. And to get a long beam in and integrate it into, in that instance, was a fireplace or a chimney. For me, that was a real constraint of the project, whereas I was quite happy to, if you wanted to thicken up the slab, go for your life, because for me, that's a very marginal cost. It's a material, sure, it's more concrete.
This, I think, is where the goalposts are moving, and it's a fascinating conversation in an area when you look at costs. I mean, for 50 years or more than 50 years, we as engineers have had it smacked into our heads, make it lighter, don't overdesign, reduce volume, reduce weight, reduce tonnage. And the big one was always structural steel. And so you would always do what you can to make your steel as light as possible. And I guess I'm talking about hot rolled beams, universal beams, universal columns and the like. And you would sharpen the pencil and do your calculations and fine-tune down to the lightest thing. And then invariably you'd find, either for architectural reasons or for strength, you might need to weld bits and pieces on. And at the end of the day, quantity surveyors still will do a really rough cost on a job based on tonnage. But where the goalposts have moved in the last 10, 15 years, that whole thing about tonnage comes out of a time when materials were expensive and labor was cheap. And it's now the other way around. So I have architects come to me on a couple of jobs where someone comes back and says, oh, there's this many tons of steel on the job and that's too much. But what I've learned is it's actually cheaper, faster, better, and more convenient for the builder in the long run to sometimes just go straight to a heavier, larger, taller bit of steel than a smaller one that then has to have extra plates and things welded to it. The cost of welding and fabrication costs is huge.
Yeah, absolutely.
Having to pair all the plates, the labor to do the steel stuff. And so I've had a few interesting conversations with architects recently where I keep saying to them, and this is before the builder gets involved, by the way, this is still at the design table, but I've had enough conversations with builders now to learn that and understand paying a bit more for the raw tonnage of the steel will ultimately cost you less in the long run than the cost of extra fabrication and detailing and so on, just to shave a few kilograms off the bill of quantities. That's been a really interesting space. The other interesting thing is I'm involved with a job at the moment. Only just last week, we are doing a very nice three-level house. It's got a basement, and part of the basement is digging a hole in the ground, and then the ground floor is suspended over that basement. And we reach the point where the ground floor gets to the end of the basement, but then keeps on going to extend to form a living and dining room. So being what I thought was a good, efficient engineer, I had the slab a little thicker where it had to span over the basement. And then when we got outside the basement and it could return to being a slab on ground, I thinned the slab up and I reduced the amount of rear, thinking, okay, well, I've saved volume, I've saved weight and tonnage and all the rest of it. The builder came to me and said, could he just keep and maintain the same slab thickness all throughout and pour a lot more concrete into the ground, because the effort it would take for him to have to change his ground levels, you know, set his membrane just for the tweak and cog and bend the steel was, for him, more time than it was just to simply run the slab throughout. And again, to my point earlier, this is where many people in the construction industry, architects, designers, engineers, we don't have that touch point as to what actually costs more on site. And the forgotten thing is time. If you can prepare that slab faster and save 3-4 days, that's actually a bigger saving than the cost of the extra concrete you poured into the ground. So time is that unknown cost that professional and consultants like myself don't get a great touch on until you've been at the coalface long enough and had enough conversations with builders.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that's that. I can totally see like one thickness, one instruction to your team, one shutter all the way along. Like it, to me, yeah, it makes perfect sense. And that was what, very similar to the conversation we had where I'm like, look, columns are really easy to buy and throw in. Beams are a pain in the ass. They're heavy, and particularly beams that are needled into brickwork. Like, oh my God, can we just make the slab as thick as you like? But that'll save us so much effort because it's still one formwork, one Rio. Like it's not going to change how long I have a steel fixer on site. It's not going to change anything apart from additional and thicker columns, I guess, and big upsized columns, I should say, and also just a little more concrete in the order. It's actually an absolute no-brainer. And yes, the that ratio of labor content to in a project has shifted. The cost of labor, material costs have effectively, I mean, you know, concrete is definitely more expensive than it used to be, but when you compare it to the cost of labor, it's an absolute no-brainer. So I think simplicity, it's about simplifying, reducing the number of components and standardizing and making it simpler is definitely more cost-effective.
There's a couple of interesting counterpoints to the discussion and just, I suppose, to play devil's advocate. One of the problems, and it comes back to what we've already talked about, the sequencing of work, is that engineer and architect will be having these discussions early on in the design phase, and then the builder typically won't get pulled into the conversation until it's been tendered out and they've won the job, and then the goalposts move. But what's interesting is if I, as an engineer, just put on my drawings at the design phase of 200 thick slab throughout when it could have been 160, 150, everyone's going to point the finger and say, oh, it's over-designed. You've made it thicker than you needed to be. You didn't sharpen the pencil. So you've got to balance that sort of feedback. And the other thing, and this is the really interesting space where it gets into slightly more touchy or political areas, is sustainability is the big thing at the moment in the construction industry. And certainly it's the big topic in the concrete industry. It was sustainability was the theme of the Concrete Convention in Australia in 2023, and it's still a hot topic for the convention in Adelaide later this year. yes, folks, there is actually a convention about concrete. But the whole thing about sustainability in concrete is reduced volume. Concrete, when you look at the data and the mix, it's actually not that bad in terms of its carbon footprint. It's the volume of it, the amount that we're using, that can be the issue. And so again, it gets hammered into you, reduce volume. The less of it there is, the less steel you need, as in reinforcing steel. And so again, we have that problem of at the design table, and certainly if you've got an architect who's wearing a green hat and is really pushing to come up with a sustainable design and tick the box with a reduced carbon footprint, and the drawings go out the door, and then the builder gets to site and says, oh, actually, no, I want to do this because it'll save time, save money, and the goalposts move a little bit. So it's an interesting space. I don't think there's a one-size-fits-all, but it's a great discussion point nonetheless.
Yeah, it comes back to, I guess, one of my core principles as an architect builder or director of an architecture and construction business is, what is the objective of that project? Sure, if the objective is to reduce carbon footprint, then 100%, different story. But if it's to reduce cost, then yeah, you have to respect, in some ways, yeah, you have to respect the will of or the objectives of the customer, right? They want a particular thing, and you have the option. If your customer doesn't care about the environment, well, you don't take them on as a customer if you're very passionate, right? It's a difficult topic, I guess. I don't know what's happening with environmental impact or carbon footprint. I think, you know, we're in an industry that inherently has a giant footprint and is not sustainable by its nature. And I think it's a conundrum. I mean, we all want to reduce carbon footprint, but we feel stuck in the mud in terms of what customers want, where we're at. And I think a lot of people are just fatigued by worrying about their carbon footprint and just putting their head in the sand. I guess that's a separate topic for another time, but it's a real conundrum.
You know, could dedicate a whole nother episode to that.
Oh, couple of episodes probably, but it's a conundrum. But today, you're like, we'll refocus on cost, because cost and affordability is the biggest thing. And I think we've had a report recently from the Housing Supply and Affordability Council. I'm not sure exactly who they are. They're one of the things that they've noted is the dominance of smaller building firms. And it's one of those things where, I don't know why, but it's a space where, and particularly in architectural construction, smaller firms dominate. And the thing I do know, it's different to every other industry. So if you look at retail, for example, a large figure, but 60-something percent of retail in Australia is enterprise level, big companies, the biggest companies control a large portion of it, where there's small, medium, and large companies dominate. In mining, it's even bigger. It's some 80% of mining company by dollar is the big companies, whereas in construction, small companies dominate. More than 50% of construction is small companies, where you have small, medium, and large. The big builders like Mirvac are the minority, actually, in construction. I wonder why that is. I don't know.
There are sectors of the industry where economies of scale come into play, and being large is good, and there are others where being large is bad. I think there's also a bit of a generational narrative at the moment, and I'm certainly not qualified to start talking about the business enterprise ambitions of Gen X versus millennials versus Gen Z and all the rest of it. I'm 51 years old. I'm very much Gen X. I came through a system where you went to uni, you started work at a firm, and you were still there 20 years later. And there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, but you're an interesting case study, because you've just stepped out, and you've stepped out of maybe a medium-sized business, and you've...
It was a small business that became a medium business. 15 when I started and 85 when I elected to depart. What amazes me, I'm now seeing a lot of what I consider to be quite young architects starting up their own practice. Architects who are still in their 20s, spending a few years, 3 or 4 years with some of the bigger firms or the more established names. And then at the age of 27, 28, 29, being brave enough to go out on their own and forming little one-person, two-person, three-person operations. Now, that's incredibly ambitious. It's entrepreneurial. I personally think it's brave, but they're all doing it and they're making a fist of it, and it's working. Again, arguably a generational thing. If you've come through and you're used to showcasing yourself and putting yourself out there on Instagram and so on, you can do those sorts of things. And there's also this narrative of people like to be their own boss now rather than work for someone else. You don't have to look at LinkedIn very long to see all these feeds come through about, you know, the big bad boss is bad. be your own boss. So I think that impacts things as well. And I hear the same in building sectors. You know, there's people who do their apprenticeship. They work for another 3-4 years and then decide, actually, you know what, it's better to be my own boss and be my own thing. And so you get tradies who've got maybe 7 or 8 years under their belt, suddenly forming their own little small practice or business, I should say. And again, they're making a fist of it. So at the moment, it doesn't really seem to be that there's too much for competition to be an issue. And I think like anything, if you lay the ground rules and you get your reputation and you get a little client base whilst you're still working for someone else, you can then go out on your own and people will follow you and you can make a fist of it. And so maybe that's what we're seeing. I remember reading a book, God, 20 years ago now, someone presented to me, it was called The Death of the Mid-Sized Practice. And it was basically a theory that the middle ground was the hard one to tread now because you were caught in no man's land between, you didn't have the efficiencies of being small, but you didn't have the economies and scale and everything that came with being big. And certainly, again, look, I only sort of have the goggles on of what I see in engineering circles, but there's a lot of small operators around now and some of the medium firms have got larger. There's a couple that have really turned themselves into huge going concerns now with almost franchise offices around the place. And a lot of these places just started as 4 or 5 people operations. So it's interesting, yeah. Somewhere in there, there's a mix between economy, efficiency, personal ambition, business models, and where the sweet spot is.
Yeah. And I guess you're a bit of an anomaly because you've exited out of a medium-sized company, but you've got a broad experience. And I think you've got broad coverage. You've got a broad spectrum of knowledge and experience and qualification. Whereas if someone jumps out at a younger age, they probably don't realize the risk they're taking on. They haven't got it covered. Like they can't possibly cover all the bases of a business. I guess I'm not that familiar with the mechanics of an engineering business, but I guess there's your insurances, accreditations, there's your personal safety management, whatever, layered on top. And some sort of a sales role as well to try and sell your services to people. You're an anomaly. You've got a reputation. You're established. You've got a big network. But if you're reasonably new to the game as a builder, engineer, or architect, you can't possibly have all those things covered all at once.
No, I don't think you do. And I agree with you. You are taking a risk, and you don't know what you don't know. And sometimes you're just lucky that you don't get that bad experience or have something go wrong, and others come a cropper. I recall David Moses from Horizon Habitat talking about this. It may actually have been on an episode of Buildopedia. I can't remember. Or maybe he was telling me some other point. But
it's Horizon now, not the Habitat.
Oh, they dropped Habitat. You're quite right. Sorry, David, if you're listening. David at Horizon. Yeah, I think he made that point about a couple of tradies can get together and form a business and start trading and not really have an understanding of insurance and risk and all the things they need to do. Was it your episode with him when he was talking about that?
Yeah, he definitely said that on an episode of Buildopedia. He definitely said that. And it's like he gets asked, the context was he gets asked to sign off on their experience. He said something along the lines of, it feels like I'm giving them just enough rope to hang themselves, right? Because he's signing off, they've got this experience and technically they can register as a builder. As a builder, he knows that they're nowhere near ready, experienced enough, or have an understanding of marketing, business, risk management, quality management, safety management. I've got a new podcast launching, which is dedicated to small builders. And it's exactly that. Like you cannot possibly cover all your bases. It's just not possible. It's just not physically possible. There aren't enough hours in a day to procure clients, hire staff, manage a team, do quality, safety, understand risk, and market yourself.
As well as the admin of doing the books and paying the bills
before
and putting
the
orders
to accounting,
in.
Don't even start. Yeah. don't even start. So yeah, I wonder how much of the cost and dysfunction in housing is that propensity for small builders to, one, be motivated, maybe because of the dysfunction within the company they're in as a factor, and how motivated they are to just go out on their own. I think your Partridge, who you work for many years, spawned many, not spin-offs, but definitely many companies rose out of people who left Partridge to start their own. We know a few between us very well of those. I wonder what it is that creates that work for yourself. But
if I remember David's comment rightly, he said, didn't he say something like, we're in this country, you can get your apprenticeship, work for a couple of years, get a shovel, and then you've suddenly got a builder's license and you're allowed to go out and trade and do work. And yet those people probably haven't done business management training or accounting training or risk management training, but they're really good at laying bricks, putting pieces, frames up and building. And you've almost got to wade into the deep end and swim and sink a little bit till you realize where you need help and where your blind spots are and where your gaps are. And then the better operators then take on other people or outsource to get those things covered. And all of a sudden, 5-10 years later, they're the successful operators and the players who then started small and are suddenly mid-size. And it gets back to what happens after that. So there's a bit of a circle going on.
You and I are of the same vintage. So my first job in construction was over 30 years ago. And I feel like I'm still learning and still working it out, you know, like this. And I feel like after 30 years, I'm just getting there. Like I'm just got all those core competencies covered, just, you know. But I kind of wonder that the interplay between this function that spawns spin-offs in companies, that spawns disasters, that spawns like what, how that all relates. But yeah, I think the dominance of smaller building firms, because in other places around the world, in the US, my understanding is very different. You have big companies doing lots of small projects. Like they're bigger, they're different. So I wonder what it is that makes us so scatty.
At the end of the day, personal ambition comes into it. And if you're the sort of person who's entrepreneurial and you want to run your own show and run your own business and have something named after yourself, you'll go down that path. I suppose people do as little or as much training or get as much as a grounding as their patience will permit until they decide, right, bugger this, I'm off to do this on my own. Or you might also have that mindset, and this drives me a little bit, is what can you see that you think you can do better? If you're in an existing system and you see that there's things that you think can be improved upon, then you go out and do it. I mean, God, 30 years ago, I got into stand-up comedy doing that. I was watching a lot of comedy at the time and thinking, oh, I reckon I could do that. I could have another crack at it. And went down that route a bit. And then the same sort of drive has driven me in other circles with music and engineering and the drinks and hospitality industry. But that's what drives me personally. Sorry, which is not what this podcast is about. But my point just being is everyone's got a different level of ambition and an appetite for risk and how grounded or conservative they feel they need to be before they push their boat out into the water.
Yeah, look, couldn't agree more. I think we should change tack because we haven't talked about innovation. This is something you wanted to talk about. We've gone down some rabbit holes, but feel free to drop some jokes on us.
No.
I keep forgetting that you had a go at stand-up. And
maybe that's the operative word. I had a go at it.
But innovation, because there's a lack of innovation. And I think one thing that I know is that there's a perception in the wider community of the construction industry being particularly backwards. And I have found zero evidence that the average builder, engineer, architect, but particularly builder, with the focus of much mockery in society, there's no evidence that they're any more or less technologically capable or challenged, or their attitude is any different to the average lawyer or accountant or anyone else. I think there's a difference in the quality of some of the tools that are available to the industry, which I'm, as a side project, working to change. But I guess I think there's no evidence of that perception being true. Sure, if you compare people in construction to people in technology, yeah, there's a difference, right? But construction as a group of people are as engaged in Facebook, Tinder, they're engaged in tech. They get Uber delivered to the worksite, food delivery, they do all of those things, they participate in tech that society does. So what is it about the lack of innovation? What is it, a perception? Is it a real thing, or is it a lack of good solutions, or is it a lack of will on behalf of the industry?
Look, those are great questions. I think there's two sort of key points you can come to. Some of it even just touches on what we just we're talking about a moment ago, and it's appetite for risk. If you're a builder and you know what you know and you're good at what you know, you probably don't want to deviate too far away from what you're good at and where your comfort zone is. So you'll stick to what's tried and true. So there's an aspect of that. There's then also familiarity and cost and change and risk. You know, some builders will, and engineers for that matter too. I know plenty of engineers who just stick to doing brick veneer homes because all they're interested in doing is timber design. And they do everything they can to avoid concrete or masonry and other things. So some businesses and people will stick to what they know and just not venture further afield. So straight away that you're shutting your door to innovation and new products, new ideas, new technology, all the rest of it. There's also a cost. There's been some amazing products that have turned up in the Australian construction industry that when they landed had a higher price tag, and for that reason they were shunned. I'll mention one of them because I was a big fan of it. I don't know if you remember, there was a Smorgenbord out of product they called the LSB, the light steel beam. And it was basically thin gauge steel that was cold formed and cold formed into a structure that looked a bit like a sea channel. And it was heralded as being something that would replace timber. And it was made specifically for domestic construction. So their target audience was the builders and the engineers working in the space, the playground that you and I play in. And it was a great product. It really was. It was stronger than timber. It was reasonably, certainly kilo for kilo, it was much stronger and could span further distances with less deflection. And, you know, the thing was, if you had to span, for example, 5-6 meters across a room, if you did that in timber, you needed a 300 deep joist. But if you used this LSB product, it would only be 200 mil because it was stronger, lighter, and so on. It was a great product. And I recall they did a big marketing campaign and would invite builders and tradies to come along to their expo nights and see it and demonstrate that you could actually cut it with a saw, a special saw on site. You know, you didn't have to send it off to the fabricators and wait weeks for it to come back. And our industry did not embrace it. Orders were slow. And after a couple of years of just no business, they decided this is no good. And it was discontinued. Very similar thing happened in the early 1990s with Palmer Tube Mills brought out a similar product called the Dog Bone. Great product. Very strong, light, efficient, but it was a new thing and people were scared of it. They didn't understand it. Engineers had relied on hot rolled steel for all these years in their books and catalogs and slow to embrace. So there's two examples of real innovative, great products coming along that just didn't find a foothold in this market, in the Australian construction industry, certainly in the residential sector. And yet we hear about all these amazing things being used overseas and they just take forever to get a foothold here. And as I said, sometimes they arrive with a higher price tag so they don't get a look in the door. And sometimes we turn our backs to them because we don't know about it. It's risk. We wait for someone else to dive in first and show that it can be used successfully before the rest of us are tempted to jump on the bandwagon.
Yeah. A counterpoint, because you said so why would people use it if it's, okay, spans better, but it's more expensive. Was it just a shunning of a product or was it like an intuition that actually in the bigger picture didn't seem to stack up, or people not embracing it, or did it just not work very well?
I think it comes down to where the rubber hits the road. For those that were looking for the engineers and boffins and tech people who were trying to come up with a lighter, stronger product, it ticked boxes. For architects who wanted to improve their ceiling heights and have a reduced floor zone, it was great from that point of view. So it impressed those two parties. But as I said, it comes to where the rubber hits the road. When the builder on site is the guy saying, no, I don't want to use that, and they're the end user at the end of the day, then you hit the dead end. So I guess that's what happened. So I don't know. In any new product development, do we need to get the builders doing the surveys and the early consultations before we get the boffins along?
I think that's a point that should be made. I went along to a green infrastructure lab launch. I realized that I was the outlier in that room. Everyone else was an academic or an industry expert who was also an academic. So I realized pretty quickly that I was in what I felt was a real echo chamber, you know, because even industry representatives that represented the blue chip builders or the, you know, I don't know exactly who was there, but the likes of Mervac or Lendlease or, you know, that they had experts there, but they were academics who were hired by the likes of Lendlease. So they were sort of adjacent to, there weren't any plumbers in the room, right? There weren't any waterproofers. And so there was a lot of talk about green roof and green infrastructure and not a tradesman in sight, it felt like it was disengaged from reality, really. I'm like, this is really weird. And you're patting each other on the back. And I'm like, this isn't really, these things are showing me they don't really work. I know they don't work. Like, my intuition as a builder is that this is, you're creating more problems than you're solving. And maybe I was wrong, and I won't mention where I was or what I was doing, or I won't mention the organization, but I felt out of place, and I felt like the people there really weren't in touch with the general contractor. The what edge?
The cutting edge, the sharp edge.
The cutting edge, the sharp edge, the edge that does the work.
The edge that does the work, exactly, yeah. That probably gives us some insight as to why that space is moving so slowly then. Because as you say, if it's an echo chamber and they're just not engaging the people that are closer to the working surface, then it is just going to be an academic conversation and not a practical outcome.
But some things have been adopted, like Dinsel, and I guess what's the class of product that Dinsel belong into? Because there's a couple of brands. Dinsel's just one brand.
I think it's been called permanent formwork systems these days.
Permanent formwork systems or plastic formwork embraced. And it took a few years.
It took a long time, to be fair. And to the point where one of the two players who sort of started in that space, AFS and Ritech, I know AFS has now actually just discontinued its original product. I guess commercial reasons and some other reasons.
But, you know, it had its down, like that's the thing. It's a bit more expensive, but there are downsides to it. Like no one wants to look at it because it's plastic, but also it's sort of waterproof, but not quite waterproof.
I think that was always the bugbear, wasn't it?
Yeah. But not only that, if you've ever built with it, you'll know that once you pour, you either have to almost do as much as you do with conventional formwork in terms of bracing it, or it's never quite straight. Right. So that's the other thing. If you're, and I know this because we used it as a methodology to reduce, it was either that or a block wall or something substantial. And we wanted to reduce the envelope, and we worked with an architect and an engineer to reduce the thickness of the wall. But we found that we had to brace the crap out of it. And even then it deformed to a point where we then had to pack out the wall. So it was in hindsight, it was a lot of effort to go to a very marginal gain and probably more cost than benefit. So
again, and I think it's that situation where I think it does lend itself to larger projects where the economies of scale start to kick in. I think the domestic houses, apart from maybe basements, it probably struggles to show its value. Our clients are chiefly homeowners looking to do quality home, and they're putting their faith and trust in all the project stakeholders, their architect, their engineer, their builder, their other consultants, council, to deliver them the product for the budget that they want to spend. And we all hear horror stories about clients say, oh, I want to spend this much money. And when the tenders come back in, it's $500,000 or more than what they were banking on. So I suppose if there's a takeaway, it's be really close and accurate with your estimates and costs and budget early on in the project. I work with a couple of architects who very deliberately hold back on things until the QS has come in and been really accurate with what's going on. And only they're getting things costed every point of the way, so that by the time they're ready to really push the button on their design and doc for the CC, they know that the job is what the client can afford. And they keep tabs on those costs and they make decisions along the way. So I guess to the homeowner who's either thinking of a renovation or a knockdown rebuild, or even just going out to Homeworld and signing up one of the project builders out there.
Is there still a Homeworld? Are you showing your age? Is there still such a thing?
There is one. It keeps moving further and further west and up to the north. You drive past it now on your way up to Windsor and Richmond.
Right. Okay. Used to be at Minchinbury.
I remember. I was in the Hills District there for a bit. Kellyville Way. Anyway, I guess my point is don't just sort of hand everything over to your consultants and wait till the price tag comes back. Be proactive. Check your costs. If you're inspired by something you saw on the Block Renovation Rescue or something, one of those shows, make sure you know what its costs are and implications are before saying to all your project team, oh, I want that product, and keep tabs on things and be very careful about the decisions you make that may have long-term cost implications that you wouldn't otherwise be aware of until build comes along and says, oh, by the way, did you know that product costs this much, or we've got to wait 6 months for it to come in from overseas or whatever. Keep tabs on things and explore innovation. And you know, there are products out there. that are cheaper, are more efficient in the long run, maybe. You know, it's funny, a bit of a sidetrack. We embrace this with other aspects of the construction industry and sustainability. We all know that if you install hydronic heating, it's very expensive to put in at the start, but then you get the payback over time. So look at things that may have a, sometimes you're discouraged by looking at the product that has a higher startup point because you lose track of the long-term gain. So consider those things. Big melting pot, but somewhere in between cost and consultants and knowledge and experience and appetite for risk and innovation, there's a sweet spot. I would encourage anyone in the construction industry to look beyond your own plate and your own field of vision to see who else on the project team can add value and improvement. And it may not always be in the obvious areas that you're used to looking at. So listen to the other consultants who've got good ideas and good experience and can draw on previous projects that show the success stories. And let's all collaborate on that front.
Yeah, and I think more broadly, like simplify your building, make them smaller and simpler. There's no magic bullet. There's no magic innovation. I think I sort of push back against whether it's prefab or digital twin or green roofs or all those innovations that are going to save the world and save us. They're not real. They're like the giant Saudi Arabian building that sort of, you know, the line or what, like it's not real. Like it's great on the sort of renders. It looks great with the CGI and the drones flying through it and the Hyperloop running in the middle of it, but they're not real. They're not real. Like, and we talked about BIM, right? It's useful on very specific complex projects, but it's not useful yet. Like nuclear fusion and prefab homes, it's always sort of like in the future. It's always in the future. Quantum computing, one of those things, always in the future, no matter what year it is. But and always some time in the future. But prefab is not a solution to a lot of things, and it certainly hasn't ever worked as a great solution for low cost housing. Like it's worked as a solution to speed up development for sure, and for high spec housing. So building economics is about simplifying and take out steel and just make it all timber for sure. That's a great solution. Make it smaller, make it leaner, make it all timber, or make it all one element. Reduce the complexity of build is the driver, I think, along with integrating a team that helps you identify what your goals are and deliver on those goals.
And an integrated team doesn't even necessarily have to be an integrated team under one roof. I mean, some of the most enjoyable projects I've been involved with are ones where, you know, I've worked with many times and done many projects together, and ditto the builder. And sure, we're three different companies, three different entities, but we've worked with each other long enough to know how we tick, to know what we look to do, and that brings efficiency. So sometimes you can have an integrated team, even though you might be going out to separate parties, but just make sure those parties know each other and get on well. And that the happiest projects I've ever been involved with were ones where it was just a great architect, a great builder, everyone got on well, and you finish the job and you're all still mates. Still working together 20 years later. That's the sweet spot.
Absolutely. No, couldn't agree more. That's a great place to probably leave it and let you get on with your crazy busy business. Andrew Durbidge.
Yes.
Thank you very much. I've got your name right. I'm very proud of myself. Andrew Durbidge, AD Consulting, if you want to look him up. Is that right?
AD Consulting Engineers.
There you go. Thanks so much, Andrew. Take care. We'll see you next time.
Thanks, Matt. Pleasure as always. Will do.
All right.
You've been listening to Buildopedia. Please remember to like us and share our episode with your friends. We'd love your comments and suggestions. And we have a new website, buildopedia.au, where you can get in touch or leave a question and check out our blog.